Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our fifth COVID-19 leave of absence Q&A forum. These forums are hosted by our CEO benefits team. Efforts putting together all the information for their team is done by Tracy Sewell and Ken. Unfortunately, Ken's unable to join us today, but he was instrumental in putting together information for this week's forum. And from the disability management team, we have Lorena Colmenares, Courtney Bishop, and myself, Catherine Laveau. The last 9 weeks of COVID-19 leave of absence, yep, you guys have been doing this for 9 whole weeks, has been quite the roller coaster ride. I think for those of us who are Disneyland fans, we would say this has definitely been an e-ticket. The purpose of our Q&A sessions is to provide you with support and answers so that hopefully you have more ups than downs on this crazy COVID leave coaster. This week, we received our fewest questions to date, and we're taking that to be a good sign. We're hoping it means that everyone's getting the hang of this, and not a sign that people are too exhausted physically and mentally to even type the questions. The fact that we've gotten fewer questions, and we think today will be a shorter session, doesn't lead any of us to be too cocky, because as we all know, every good roller coaster ride is full of lots of unexpected twists and turns. So today we're going to follow our usual Q&A format. Tracy's going to read the questions that are posted. Courtney will read the answers. And Lorena and myself will be here to provide additional support if there are need for clarification or additional information. As we've done for the past 4 sessions, we will be recording this session as well, and we will post the recording along with the document with the actual written out responses on the HR COVID-19 site. Currently, you are all muted, but you are welcome to ask questions throughout the presentation, and in fact, we encourage and invite that. And Lorena will briefly explain to you how you can submit your questions.
Good morning, everyone. Hopefully everybody's doing fine. So in order for you to submit a chat, you go under your toolbar and you click on participant, and you can either wave your hand or submit a chat through there. Thank you.
All right. So without further ado, we're going to have Tracy and Courtney get started with questions and answers.
All righty. Good morning, everyone. We will start with question we have labeled 54, since we're continuing from previous questions. Is it true that if an employee has a fever when they are screened at work, they must stay home from work for 7 days? What if they provide a doctor's note that says they are negative for COVID? If it is true, how should the employee code the time they are not allowed back to work?
The answer is, it is correct that if an employee has a fever, they need to stay home. However, we are not aware of any requirement that they remain home for 7 days. If the employee believes their condition is related to COVID-19, you should follow the COVID-19 exposure process charts, which detail the process, including the employer's time. The employee's time should be coded. These charts are posted on the COVID-19 webpage, and a link has been provided for your reference as well.
All right, moving to question 55, will the county be recommending to extend employees' leave of absence once they exhaust their 12 weeks of expanded FMLA for childcare?
The answer is no. However, the employee should be evaluated based on their own circumstances and available entitlements. The employee should return to work unless they have been extenuating personal medical circumstances under ADA or FEHA, or a personal leave of absence may be considered.
All right. Question 56. A 980 employee on an intermittent leave takes a full 9-hour day off. The employee opts to use 4 hours of natural disaster pay and then chooses to use EPSL EFMLA in coordination for the remaining 5 hours. Would we calculate EPSL EFMLA for 2/3 up to 200 max of 5 hours or 9 hours, since they are taking the full day off?
The answer is you should calculate based on the remaining 5 hours. Doing the calculation based on 9 hours means you would need to change the proportions from 5 to 6 hours of natural disaster pay and 3 hours of EFMLE. The end result should be that the employee is not overpaid based on their daily and aggregate limits. You should have to adjust the numbers for the day off if you are trying to maximize the daily limit.
All right, question 57. If an employee requests to use 2/3 benefits as provided under EPSL and EFMLE due to COVID school daycare closure for 12 weeks, would it be correct to tell the employee that their total maximum paid benefits is 320 hours, not to exceed the 200 per day or 12,000 aggregate?
No, the 2/3 benefits is for up to 10 weeks, not up to 12 weeks, equal to roughly 267 hours. You should state the limits as referenced in the employee rights FFCRA notice to avoid any confusion or misunderstanding by giving your own estimates. You may have already misinformed an employee.
And just to clarify on this one, the 10 weeks is the EFMLA, and the 2 weeks is the EPSL. So total 12 weeks, yes, but the emergency FMLA is 10 weeks. So I think that's what this answer was referring to. Question 58, and if this employee already received county paid disaster benefits, which ran concurrently with EPSL, what happens if the employee was paid more than $200 a day in county paid disaster benefits? Is an adjustment needed or no adjustment as long as they don't exceed the 12,000 aggregate?
The natural disaster pay does not have a daily aggregate limit, so no adjustment would be necessary. If no longer eligible for natural disaster pay, but the employee is eligible for EPSL or EFMLA, you should be applying the daily as well as the aggregate limits. If either limit was exceeded while only eligible for EPSL or EFMLA, the employee should repay any overpayments. In addition, if they were overpaid the daily limit, the amount could be added back to the aggregate to be used at a later date.
Alrighty, question 59. At the present time, I have half my staff in the office and the other half teleworking. I have an employee who is teleworking due to comorbidity issues. It seemed like a natural decision to allow this employee to telework due to their existing medical circumstances. They have been telling other employees that they like working from home and hope to continue to do so on a permanent basis. I have some concerns that they may want to work from home on a permanent basis, but the position does not support working from home. If they provide a note from their doctor, what steps should I pursue after the stay-at-home order is lifted?
When the stay-at-home order is lifted, you would handle any request for accommodation exactly as you would have prior to the shelter-in-place order, meaning you will need proper documentation from the employee regarding the requested accommodation. You will need to explore all reasonable accommodations associated with the medical documentation, and you will need to conduct an interactive process meeting regarding the requested accommodation.
And I'm going to put the clarifier on that piece is that I know a lot of this has been very complicated, integrating the COVID parts into the leaves and the benefits, but the more you can defer yourself back to once the shelter in place is no longer in effect, and there are going to be people who may still have concerns and may have valid concerns about returning to work, you revert to your normal best practices that you used before we were faced with it. So just try to remember how we all used to do this, and that should be what you use as sort of your guide going forward. Anthony Lurie has said that it sounds like fun, and I agree with him. it's like a roller coaster ride. Thanks for noticing.
Oh, all right. Question 60.
I would also add that I'm sure it'll be easy in addition to fun. Sorry. Go ahead.
No worries. Question 60. We have an employee out due to the age order with underlying health conditions. She is going by the governor's age order of 65 plus, which happens to be where her age bracket falls into. The Ventura County order is 75 plus or 70 plus with active or unstable comorbidity. Her supervisor indicated this employee is not planning on returning until the stay-at-home order is lifted or until specific staff start returning. Does it matter which age order they are following?
We are not able to find language in the governor's stay-at-home order that specifically addresses the 65-plus age bracket, and it is to our understanding that our county's stay-at-home order could be more restrictive than the governor's, but not less restrictive. Therefore, we believe the county's order is in alignment. If the employee has documentation that differs, they should provide the information and it should be considered when determining if when staff within the stated age brackets return to the work site.
All right. Question 61. I'm still going through the attestation form submitted and providing the leave paperwork to employees that have been out for more than 3 days. Some employees are adamant that they are or were not on a leave of absence. How much should we enforce getting the leave paperwork returned?
You should enforce our leave policy and document that you have provided the necessary forms in accordance with our leave policy. If proper paperwork is not submitted, the employee would be deemed absent without approval and therefore not eligible for any pay on the days they were out.
Yeah, just to add to that, just going back to the beginning when we were dealing with these attestation forms, those forms are not permitting the employee to be on leave. It's only for pay. So if they're not submitting leave forms, they're not eligible for pay. And that attestation form is basically mute, null, void. So we definitely need to try to get the paperwork if they've been out for more than 3 days per our policy. And that's to protect the employee and the employer both.
And we've had a request if we would all be willing to put our arms up in the air like we're really on a roller coaster.
Woo!
Woo!
All right, hopefully that pleases the crowd. All right. It's fun here.
Yeah, this is great. Okay. So last question, 62. Childcare businesses have started to reopen. I think they've been open, but that's okay. Some are just starting to reopen. For those that have been out due to childcare closure, their childcare has now become available. They are wanting to continue to be out for the following reasons. Until the stay-at-home order is lifted, even though they do not fall into any COVID-19 related category, prefer to continue to provide the childcare due to the safety of their child. What do we do in these situations?
The employees should be evaluated based on their own circumstances and available entitlements. The employees should return to work unless they are accentuating family medical circumstances under FMLA, assuming FMLA has not been exhausted, or personal medical circumstances under FMLA, ADA, FEHA, as a last resort, a personal leave of absence may be considered, subject to the agency's discretion.
And I think we have a question that relates to number 61. The question is, when you say they are not eligible for pay, does that mean they can't use their vacation time?
Well, so vacation, it's up to the agency whether vacation is approved or not. So we've always provided guidance that if the leave paperwork is not submitted, the employee is absent without approval, and therefore no pay, vacation, sick, natural disaster pay, none of it. They're not eligible for any of it. I mean, I shouldn't say eligible. Sure, they're eligible to use vacation pay, but if it's not approved, they can't use it. And it shouldn't be approved if they're absent without approval. It's just a way for you to, you know, a tool for you to use to get the paperwork in.
And I think that, you know, in all these things, when we're looking at these various entitlements and things like accommodation, the employee is asking for a benefit. And in order to, there are obligations or requirements the employee has to meet in order to receive those benefits. So if they want a certain entitlement or they're requesting a certain type of accommodation or a leave, part of the process is that they need to participate in good faith and do their part in completing either the paperwork or participating in interactive process. Otherwise, we don't have the information we need to move forward and authorize things. So as I said, this was our, we got one more quick question here. Sorry, I'm getting them in weird places. Let's see. Rachel, you just sent one, and for some reason it's not popping up on the, are you able to send it to all? Or maybe let me see if I can pull it up here. Okay, got it. Sorry, I found it here. So regarding the first question today, which she thinks is question number 54, the Appendix A1 COVID-19 work reentry information, which is page 6, that was sent out last Friday, states that an employee cannot come back to work in the building for 7 days if they have a fever. So it's a great point that you raise, in that obviously there's some inconsistency there. So I think we're going to need to internally take a look at the fact that these are inconsistent in the information, and we need to get you guys some clarity on that. So that is correct. If that's what that information says on page 6, and I don't have it open in front of me, but I'm trusting that you are correct on that, Rachel, then we need to circle back with you guys on that particular point. Because obviously the two don't quite reconcile. So we will put this on our follow-up list, and as we've done in the past on things where we need to seek clarity, we will provide you the information as soon as we have it. And I think, you know, this is really helpful in that way too, in that it's not just us giving you guys information. As you come across these types of things, it's very helpful to us because we are trying to sort through as much information as you guys are, trying to get it all sort of assimilated and put together. And sometimes things are missed because so much is coming out so quickly and changing so often. So we really do appreciate your feedback too, because this helps us to make sure we're all on the same page and all doing this correctly. So those seem to be our questions, at least. Oh, got one more. Okay. We have an employee who has applied for UIB, but we do not know if they have been approved. They are on an approved childcare leave of absence related to COVID-19 and are receiving the 2/3 pay for up to 10 weeks. Can we confirm that we should be adjusting their pay with the expectation that they will receive the UIB weekly benefits, or should we wait to confirm that they have received the benefit?
Yeah, so that's a tough one because we have not been provided with the criteria that UIB or the EDD is using to approve unemployment benefits. If you look at their frequently asked questions on their website, they say when somebody asks that question, they say, like, people are asking the question, how do I estimate what I'm going to receive or if I'm even going to be able to receive? And the answer that they're giving is, we can't give a straight answer, just have the person apply. And so that leaves us in a tough position as this question shows, how do you administer the pay for those people? So we know that they are eligible for the two-thirds pay up to the daily and aggregate limits. So continue to pay them that, at least that. As far as the rest, I mean, I guess I don't know if I would factor in unemployment until the person actually gets a letter saying you've been approved and here's what how much you're going to be receiving. At that point, we can probably go back and just do adjustments. I know it's a hassle, and repay agreements are certainly something we want to avoid at all costs, for everybody's sake. But that's the only advice I could give is, I guess I would not consider it a for sure thing until the employee gets the piece of paper that shows them they're approved, or the email. I think they're emailing out when they get approved.
And we've gotten some comments and questions. So first, in response to your answer, Tracy, the response back is perfect. That's what we were planning to do, but we wanted to make sure we shouldn't adjust until confirmation of approval for UIB. So it sounds like we're on the same page there.
And then
another question that I think sort of is touches on that is just that we got a comment that some groups are starting to see a trend of the employee wanting to just use unemployment LWOP because they're making more money off work.
Yep, we have heard that too. It's unfortunate, but I think I could be wrong. I know that once they're approved, we're going to receive something that says how much they're receiving. So it just takes time. And unfortunately, the employee is going to know way before we find out how much they're getting. So just remind your employees that are out, if they could send you their approval letter or email as soon as they get it, that's the best we can do, I think.
Then going back to the question about the 7 days with the fever, there was comment that to add to that first question, they've seen a couple of notes from doctors or medical screening stations that state if someone has a fever or COVID-19 related symptoms, they should be self-quarantined for a minimum of 7 days or 72 hours after symptoms resolve, whichever is longer. And that is all true. Where this becomes a little bit tricky is that not everyone who has a fever has COVID. So you might send an employee might fail the screening and then call their doctor and find out they have strep throat. And they get medication and they may be cleared in different ways. So I think where we need to seek the clarity here is again, to me, where we go back to these workflow processes is that we're going to say you can't be at work. And now if you think you have COVID, that's one version of things. Or, you know, you can't be at work with your fever. And if you get past 3 days, we're going to need a doctor's note. So something in there has to give, whether your fever relates to COVID or if you have a sinus infection, we're going to need to seek some clarification. If, though, the employee thinks it's COVID related, those workflow charts are going to be what guide us. And again, it's going to be a medical provider who's going to say, okay, based on your fever and what you've described to me, patient, I think you either need COVID testing and you need to be quarantined for 7 days, or you have a sinus infection and here's a Z-Pak and you can go back to work and here's a note. So I know these are really nuanced little differences, but it is, but there are differences, right? So I'm not sure that the answer is that it's automatic that you have a fever that you can't be in for 7 days. We will certainly look to clarify the ways in which the documents read between the various information that's been provided. But I think there are sort of case-specific circumstances that are going to come into play. I've got a comment, and I'm not sure. Maybe I went. Oh, we're okay. Going back to, I think the approval letter regarding the UIB. I got a message that says the approval letter does not include 600, though, from seeing the letters that this person has seen.
Oh, that's interesting. So they're not even factoring in the extra 600, or not telling us that they are receiving that. Interesting.
And they're saying that is correct.
Wow. Well, that makes it really difficult for us. How do we know? I mean, I guess we just assume, because I believe anybody who qualifies for unemployment right now is receiving that extra 600. So do we just assume?
They said to you that is correct also, what you just said.
Hmm. I mean, I guess I would assume, and unless the employee can prove to you that they did not receive the 600, I would assume that they received it, since their website says it's over and above anything else that they're approved for. So.
And we got another comment from someone who said, it's my understanding if the employee is receiving at least $1 in UIB benefits, they get the 600 per the EDD website.
Yep. So that's our understanding as well, that they're getting it irregardless. If they're approved, regardless of the amount, they're getting that extra 600. So I would factor that in. Anything that you get that shows the amount they've been approved for, factor in that extra 600 a week.
So, there's a question that they've heard that July 27th is when the $600 benefit ends. Do we know if that is correct?
Interesting. We'll have to look into that. That's good information. I had not heard that yet.
Then I got another one that says, keep in mind that the letter they may have received from EDD regarding their benefit amount will probably not include the $600.
True. Sounds like it. So, yeah.
And so the ending on July 27th apparently is on EDD website right now. So again, these are, we'll take as our follow-ups and try to make sure that, you know, that the information you guys are getting, that yes, we have that information too, and we're all on the same page. And then we have a comment with regards to this whole piece of it about them getting more money, is that it should make it really easy to return staff to work. Lots of motivation to return and make less. Sure, that's another fun part of the staff since COVID roller coaster. So, I mean, obviously, if an employee can make more money at home than at work and be with their children who, you know, they have all these other things that are happening, these are going to be real struggles that, you know, unfortunately, I think everybody feels like a little bit, we've finally gotten a handle on how to process these things. And now is going to come part two, where we're slowly entering into reopening. And now the realities of these benefits and how they apply and what they mean will create you guys the next phase of the challenge, which will be, how do you bring people back? How do you incentivize them to come back? And of course, you're going to get a for extent for the very reason. Another one on regarding attempting to coordinate with unemployment amounts. An employee advised them that they did not have to give any information, as unemployment is not a disability benefit. Is it written anywhere that they are required to coordinate unemployment and the EFMLA payments?
It's not written anywhere, but an employee... I believe it says, well, and I could be wrong, but we've always at least verbally said an employee cannot make more money off than on. It may say it in the leave of absence handbook, but I can't say for certain. I just know that that's something that we've always said. So there maybe is no written thing saying the employee has to provide us their unemployment benefit amount, but if they don't, then I guess we just assume, I mean, at least calculate in the $600 if we know that they've been approved. We're going to get, they send the employer a notice saying what the employee was approved for. So we're going to eventually get notification. And yes, they need to coordinate unemployment with EFMLA. They can't be making more off than on if we're aware of those payments.
And I think Tracy raises a great point, is that because all of you know, sometimes this happens with workers' comp where a case is delayed or even denied. And then, you know, a year down the road after litigation and other things, we end up picking it up and we have to go back. And then there is an overpayment and the employee gets notification that they, you know, have an overpayment of $5,000. And there's all these implications. That creates a lot of stress for everybody, including the employee. I mean, hopefully in advising them that we will at some point get accounting for everything that they received. And that if we don't, you know, eventually there will need to be a reconciliation. So we're trying to avoid for them now that headache, which is a much bigger problem for everyone down the road. Okay, we have another one. If we don't get any EDD information from the employee in a timely period, will your office contact us with the information or can we get it from you if asked?
So we don't receive those in our office, so we won't know. Those typically go to the individual agency HR reps or payroll reps. So you'll have to be on the lookout in your own agencies for that documentation.
Who collects on an overpayment, EDD or the County of Ventura?
We would. I mean, we're going to be looking at what all the benefits were that they collected, and then also what they were paid on county payroll, and then we would be collecting any overpayment. If they were indeed overpaid on the EDD end, yeah, I'm sure they would seek reimbursement, but really it's up to us to collect an overpayment if we were paying money on our end and they were collecting benefits from other entities like EDD.
Any other questions? We'll give it a minute or two for people to be able to think them over and submit. And I will say, this is the good part about these Q&A forums, is today you guys have a lot of questions that we didn't necessarily anticipate were going to be the sort of some of the pain points. So it helps us to understand what you're up against in better being able to get you information that you need. One more. Once the FMLA time under the Expansion Act is out, will the flex credit extend per the MOA while collecting unemployment?
Right. So the flex credits extensions per the MOA, it's once they go unpaid from the county. So whenever that is, whenever they go completely unpaid, no more paycheck from the county, then you start counting the MOA provisions. So if they're just collecting unemployment and not integrating with any accruals after their FMLA time, Expansion Act time runs out, then that's when the clock will start ticking on the MOA provisions.
I'll give it another minute or two just to see if anything else pops up. Okay, looks like everybody's gotten their questions in that they wanted to. So, you know, again, none of us picked this wild, scary, stressful, crazy, and occasionally exhilarating COVID roller coaster ride, but you know, we just want to say from CEO Benefits and from Disability Management Division, we're happy to be taking this ride with such a great county. We appreciate all of your time and your participation. We will continue to host these as long as you have questions. We will host them in hopes that it provides you support and answers that makes this all a little bit less stressful for all of you. So we thank you again for your time and participation today and wish everyone a very happy and safe Memorial Day weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, everyone. We're almost done.